Well, I think that some of you may be disappointed in this study or my approach if you're looking for directly applied lessons. If you want to know, like, well, what does this mean? How am I going to live different today? But, you know, when I think about that, as we're going through Genesis, this is our fifth week and last week in the book of Genesis. I think back to that book I mentioned to you a couple weeks ago that I read with my son for his English class, an Agatha Christie mystery novel. And I remember he said to Kelly, after he'd read the first couple chapters, "It's boring." And then I read the first couple chapters and I realized why he said that, because it's all introduction and characterization. There's not the action. The people aren't dying yet. And that's not exactly true with Genesis. People are dying. There's a lot of lessons, a lot of morals, I'm not going to take any of that away, but Genesis is the first book in something that's much bigger. And if you read it like you're supposed to get everything out of it, it's like reading the Agatha Christie novel and expecting to get, you know, glorious lessons out of the first two chapters. Not, again, you can out of Genesis, so the analogy fails there, but things get better.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Musical chair.
You're not used to sitting there. That's okay.
Things get better as you get further along. So we're laying foundation, and I hope this morning that you'll see some things you haven't seen before. We're not going to talk so much about the glorious reconciliation between Joseph and his brothers. That's good. We're not going to talk about how Joseph was really such a wise leader and a man of integrity who should be emulated. And we're not going to talk about him so much for two reasons. One, because you probably heard about them already, and so with limited time, we're going to talk about other things. And our focus in this whole study, Genesis to Revelation, what's the Bible all about, I want to look at the kind of the central thread, the driving force. To say it this way, there are other people of integrity whose stories weren't written. Why was Joseph's written, or why was the conflict between Jacob and Esau, or any of these others? So I'll pass out these handouts. I should have asked Nelson how many people he counted here to see. I printed off 40, thinking that everybody could have a copy, but I don't know how many are here. We have eight rows of five each would be about 40. So probably everybody can have one except me, I guess. I am. Genesis, the book of Genesis has a built-in structure. It is not four events for people. I know that's an easy way to remember the book. Garden of Eden, the fall, flood, Tower of Babel, and then the four major, you know, the patriarchs and Joseph. That's an easy way to remember the book. That's not the way the writer of Genesis structured the book. I'm not going to talk a lot about this. It's not critical for what we're doing today, but maybe just mention to you, there is in Genesis 10 times a phrase, a line, a sentence that you've probably ignored, possibly ignored. It's translated different ways in different versions. It's all translating the same word in Hebrew. In Genesis 37:2, which I just happened to open to, it says in the NIV, "This is the account of Jacob." There is 10, or in chapter before, "This is the account of Esau." Back in chapter 25, it'll say, "This is the account of Isaac." And so on. But there's 10 of these statements. And the word in Hebrew is toledot. And I don't tell you that, you have to remember it, but because I might slip and say it in here, and then you'll know, oh yeah, toledot. And also I can use it because the reason why there are different translations in English is because there's disagreement and debate about what the word means, but it really shouldn't be. It's really not that hard. And the NIV translation is wrong. The new NIV, which I don't like for other reasons, gets it right, and it adds on, instead of saying, as I read back here in Genesis 37, this is the account of Jacob, that's not true. Right? This is the account of chapter 37, verse 2, this is the account of Jacob. And then what's from chapter 37 on? It's about Joseph and the other sons. So the correct translation in the New NIV says, this is the account of Jacob's family line. The word toledot comes from a word which means descendants or offspring, birth. So it's not the account of Jacob. It's the account of Jacob's descendants. This is the account of Esau in the chapter 4. It's not the account of Esau. We don't learn anything about Esau. We learn about his generations. That's another way to translate it. These are the generations of... Okay, so what's the take home for us? Or what's the thing... how does this help us this morning? I put on the front of your handout an outline. A partial outline of the book of Genesis. It's only the section we're dealing with today. It's the last four toledot, or the last four of these family lines, which run from Genesis 25 to the end of the book. That tells us how the author framed the book. There are six others before that in section that we're not looking at. This is the account, Genesis 2:4 begins it off. This is the account of the heavens and the earth. And so forth. But so we have in our section today, we kind of want to say, like, how are we going to handle chapter 26 to 50? That's 20. Are we looking at 25 or 26 chapters today? 26 chapters. We're starting in 25. Well, we're not really starting, but that's what we're responsible for today. So how are we going to tackle these 26 chapters? Well, by looking at the author's organization will help us. And you see it's really easy because there's four of them. And I tried to help you by changing the font size to show that two of the four are short and not so important. Now, doesn't mean they're not important. The writer put them in there. But they're less. And so like in Genesis 25, this is the toledot of Ishmael. It's only seven verses. So you don't want to compare that with 14 chapters for the toledot of Jacob. And why is it here? It's partly here to contrast. Ishmael gets a little bit of time, a little bit of interest. He does get some of God's blessing, but he's not the chosen seed. The chosen line gets all the attention because that's where God's working. That's where God is passing on his promises. So, and that's a big part. If you say, what's going on in Genesis? And I don't know if you read through this week and you're just thinking, like, there's all these details, and how do you sort it out, and how do you keep, like, this is prominent and this is not? And one of the things that's going on is the selection. God saying, this one, not that one. Isaac, not Ishmael. Jacob, not Esau. And then when you get to the 12 tribes, what is it? It's not. There's no none. Grammatically way. There's no none who are excluded. All 12 sons are chosen. They're all of Jacob. There's no selection there with regard to in or out. They're all going to form the nation, right? 12 tribes, the nation of Israel. But there is going to be one who is preeminent, actually a couple. But Joseph and Judah both. But so we have this selection process by which the reader can see. And I put also on your handout on the bottom of the first page, questions that the reader, questions that the reader would have. Who has read Genesis, right? Genesis has been read ever since it was written, certainly in the time of Moses. So for more than 3,000 years, people have been, but even really before Moses, I think, This knowledge was being passed on, whether it was oral or written. And so people are saying, Who am I? They say people who are the people who are asking this? They're Israelites. Who am I? Is there really a God? Is he really, you know, is there really only this God? And now, you know, I'm part of the chosen people. What does that mean? Where did that come from? How did that work? And so Genesis is answering a lot of those questions. And one of the things it's doing is it's saying, you are in the promised line because you're of the seed of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Unlike, and here's just a modern example. If you're of the line of Ishmael, and the Ishmaelites were all around, who carried Joseph as a slave down to Egypt? It was Ishmaelites. So the Ishmaelites are part of their world. The Edomites, descendants of Esau, are all another part of their world. And they can't say, I mean, they might try to say, as this modern example I'm going to give you in a second here, well, no, we get the divine blessing. I mean, our God is really the true God. You know, what the Muslims say about the sacrifice of Abraham, right? They say it was Ishmael, not Isaac. Well, is that true? Okay, you can go to Genesis and find the answer. So that's one of the things. You see, God is sovereign in election. You see, it's not, well, how do I say this? This is where the area where I don't take any questions when we talk about election and responsibility. But I was going to say, it's not arbitrary, but I mean, God is wise, so I don't even want to use the word arbitrary in the discussion. But we'll start 25, and we're not trying in any way to cover every chapter, but with Jacob and Esau, God chose, right, I think this is a helpful example. God chose Jacob, the younger, to be greater than the older, when? Before they were born. Now, that's not fair. Right? I mean, I didn't even get a choice. I didn't get a say. Which, by the way, right? Nobody gets a choice in where they're born, or when they're born, or to whom they're born. But this is God's sovereign will, and He can decide, I'll make you younger and you older. I'll make you greater and you lesser. And He does. So before they're born, God, and this isn't just like who's, hey, Ron, we got a chair for you here. It's not just like with, you know, with us today in our world, right? You have to just not make that analogy. It's not like, well, I'm, you know, a twin and my brother and, this is the chosen seed, the one to whom, I mean, God said to Abraham, through you I will bless the world, and whoever blesses you will be blessed, and whoever treats you lightly or poorly will be cursed. So that's the blessing that's at stake, and God, who gave the promise, who made the covenant, can choose who He's going to continue it on through. So, We're saying that God is absolutely sovereign in the election of Jacob. But it's also noteworthy and recorded that Esau's character showed that that was a good choice. I'm not saying that God looked ahead, saw what Esau would do, and said, okay, well, I guess I'll choose Jacob because Esau really doesn't have any regard for the covenant, right? That's what's going on there. The birthright, this is not a light thing. We can, you know, when we were kids or even when we're not less kids, we make stupid, foolish decisions on the moment, and that this is not that. I mean, well, it was a stupid, foolish decision on the moment. It was, we're not talking about, you know, we're talking about the covenant promise blessing of God. And that's what Esau says. Oh, just give me a meal. I don't care about that. We also see it with Esau in his choice of wives. Which is, you say, you know what? What's the big... No. Just go back and see how Abraham was so adamant that Isaac marry the right woman because it would place everything in jeopardy. And Esau deliberately, and the narrator of Genesis wants us to know intentionally, because he brackets, he puts it at the beginning and at the end, Esau married foreign women who displeased his parents. So you can't miss it. You shouldn't miss it. So I'm kind of showing you here how two sides fit together. God's sovereign choice and election before they were born is born. The wisdom of that is born out in Esau's character, which is displeasing to God in a very grave measure, with the despising of the covenant and no intention of perpetuating in a godly way. So. Now, to tie in there, let's tie in here Isaac, because this is something that can be missed. And you see on the outline that I gave you, we don't have any extras, do we? I mean, I should remember what I wrote. But we got all kinds of them here. Okay, so I'm going to take one, and then if you missed one, we have plenty, so everybody can get one. If I just see it, it's just we have Toledot, forgive me for using that word, the account of the family line of all of these major characters in the book of Genesis, except for Isaac. That is to say, we don't have an account of Abraham's family line, which would be Isaac. We do have one for Ishmael, we have one for Esau, we have one for Jacob. We do not have any family history of Isaac. If you kind of feel like, I want to know more about Isaac, I know all this about Abraham, all this about Jacob, Joseph, but Isaac, he is skipped. Now, why? I'm going to suggest that it is related to the Jacob and Esau thing. Right? What did I just say? Before Jacob and Esau were born, God said, revealed, stated specifically that the older would serve the younger. So what is Isaac trying to do? He tries to thwart God's plan by blessing Esau. Now, I don't think Isaac was... I mean, he's a patriarch. He was blessed by God. I'm not saying everything bad about Isaac. I think he had a better start in his life. I think he was faithful to God. I think the sacrifice where he laid down on the altar, good. There are a number of good things. He's praying for his barren wife, and God answers that prayer. But at the end of his life, at least at the point, he wasn't quite dead, but getting closer, he tries to subvert God's plan by blessing his favorite son, Esau. Why was Esau his favorite son? Food. Food. Isaac loved the tasty game that Esau got. Jacob didn't bring that. Isaac did. Esau did. So sensual desires prevailed in Isaac's life. He tried to subvert. Now, God's will is not thwarted, right? I mean, God gets his way. Unfortunately, it's through deception, right? Jacob and his mom, there was the right idea there in the sense that, no, God said, Jacob gets the blessing. It was wrong in the way they went about it, right? What they should have they done, trust God. God, this is, maybe go and talk to Isaac and say, Isaac, the Lord said this. We're going to be in direct defiance. You know, and let the Lord take, instead of, what's the result of the deception of Jacob dressing up like Esau and doing all that? The family is broken apart for the next couple decades. And, of course, God uses even that. And that's another thing you can just, I mean, like a theme or a thread or like what's going on in Genesis, especially the last half of Genesis. You could capture it all in the words that Joseph says at the end of the book. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That's again and again. That's Isaac meaning for evil, but God works it out so Jacob gets the blessing. Many examples of that. So, yes.
Just real quick. when I was reading that, I read it, I guess, the other way, and I might have been wrong, but, you know, it said the Lord said to her.
To Rebecca?
So I was reading it more thinking that the Lord spoke to Rebecca about it, not to Isaac. And as you read the story, Rebecca's deceptive and everything. And
right.
So I was thinking the other way, kind of like, well, not that Isaac knew and was seeking to change things, manipulate things, but it was Rebecca the whole time who knew, and because of, I guess, customs and all of that, began trying to manipulate it to happen.
Hmm.
But
it does say the Lord revealed this to Rebecca. It doesn't say that Rebecca told her husband,
right.
But it's very, very hard to imagine that she didn't. And that, I mean, that's not a small little detail. That's sort of what we're all about in this chosen, faithful
right.
family in the midst of the evil world. So I'm going to believe that they shared that, they knew that, and Isaac went against that. But I would agree that Rebecca's methods are wrong, and because of that, the narrator punishes her too. How so? Because after she does the deal with Jacob and sends him away and says, Esau's going to kill you, better run, that's it. The narrator never comes back and tells, doesn't even, this is unique for Rebecca, no mention of her burial. Everybody else is mentioned, but Rebecca. So it's sort of it seems to be a punishment on her. That doesn't mean right that she won't be in heaven or that she wasn't godly to begin with. I think she clearly was. Genesis 24 is a remarkable story about just how faithful she was. But it is, and this is another kind of what's going on here in all these lives of these patriarchs and all these mistakes, and that's the reality is. The patriarchs were faithful and faithless, right? They honored God and they stumbled and fell. And they did it in different times in different ways. Jacob's life, Isaac's kind of went, if I was to graph it on a chart, I'd start high on the faithfulness, Isaac, and then down by the end, he's not. But Jacob starts off deceiving, tricking, deceiving everybody in his path. And he ends up being a good leader of his family, I would think. That's one of the things that, you know, the Israelite, right, Joe Israelite, living 100 years later or 500 years later, can look and say, Father Abraham was faithful in this way, and he was blessed. And Father Jacob, you know, whenever he was scheming, when he was resorting to his own means, then things went bad and he suffered consequences. But still, God was gracious. God gives what we don't deserve. And that's a constant theme throughout the lives of the patriarchs. I mean, Jacob had just tricked his father and got the blessing. Let's go there, 28. There's so much. I didn't even bother figuring out what I was going to say this morning. Exactly. Just there's so much. There's, you know, we'll hit on some of them and hopefully I won't miss anything critical. But I did tell you in the preparation for today's reading, I said, please pay extra attention to anything God says or any conversation between God and man. That's the part to highlight. Now, the action sequences are nice, they're fun, and they make for a better movie, if you want to, put this into Hollywood, but it's God's speech. So, for instance, in chapter 28, oh, Cindy, you have a chair for you? Well, and I wouldn't have done it except you're related, but... In 28, what do we want to argue about? We want to say, was it a ladder? Was it a stairway? Were the angels on the top or on the bottom? Or how are they going? And who cares? I mean, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that this is God appearing to Jacob. And that matters because of what he says. What does God say to Jacob, who just tricked his dad and got the blessing which God had promised that he would get before he was born? But he says, I am Yahweh, the God of your father, I mean, verse 13, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Right? Remember, Jacob has a rock for a pillow. He doesn't have a sleeping bag, let alone a tent or a house or land or anything. He doesn't have tribes. He doesn't have family. He doesn't have a friend. And God says, the land you're lying on, I give it to you and your seed. Your seed will be like the dust of the earth. And you will be spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your seed. I mean, is that mind-blowing? This deceiver on the run with a rock for his pillow. And so who's the hero of Genesis? Right? It's God. But it's all about what God does through people who need grace. And the book of Genesis is all about God being faithful to his promises despite one threat after another. I should read the rest of what God says here. I'm with you and will watch over you wherever you go. I'll bring you back to this land. I'll not leave you until I've done what I promised you. So let's talk about threats. I didn't put the word threats in the title. I wrestled with this title for a bit. Here's what I ended up with. God's preservation of his promises to the patriarchs. But that they're implicit in that, the preservation of the promises, is that there are threats. So that's just a whole other way to view this section here, is what are the threats to the promises? Well, one threat we talked about is that Isaac wants to bless the wrong boy. The boy who's marrying ungodly women. Another threat is barrenness. Again and again, right? Isaac's wife Rebecca is barren. Jacob's wife Rachel is barren. Judah, for whom is going to be the promised seed, has three sons, but none of them have any kids. So there's the end of that, except for this Canaanite woman. Let's talk about her for a minute. Chapter 38. I remember, I'm not supposed to say this, when I came to DTS, it was now 5 years ago, I had an entrance examination to get in. It was an oral interview with the professors. I thought they were going to say, like, what's your name, and where have you been living, and why do you want to enter our program? And they're saying, like, so what's Genesis 38 doing in the Bible? You know, that's a good question. I said, I've been wondering about that. Here's the answer. Because Genesis 38, the story of Judah and Tamar, seems strange. Because it's the stories about Joseph. What's the Judah thing doing in here? Joseph isn't in the chapter at all. Now, you could say, well, it shows a contrast in the sexual integrity of the two. It does. Because Judah is sleeping with what he thinks is a shrine prostitute on the side of the road, and Joseph is of the utmost integrity, running away from Potiphar's wife and all that costs him. That's not why. That's good. That's nice, and that's a good teaching lesson. But that's not why chapter 38 is in there. The story of Judah and Tamar, it's not just one thing going on. There's more than one thing. But one of the things is to show how God protects the nation of Israel by moving them to Egypt. What do you mean? Because in Egypt, how did they view the Israelites? these people from the land of Canaan. They looked down on them. They wouldn't eat with them. They certainly wouldn't live with them or intermarry with them. That is critical. Because Judah and the 12 sons living in the land of Canaan, what are they going to be tempted to do? They're going to marry Canaanite women. The issue isn't race. The issue is faith. What happens if they do? They assimilate. Why does that matter? Because God has made a promise. This is a major threat to the promise. If the children of the chosen one intermarry and become Canaanites and their family, there's no more promise. There's something else going on, and it's very important, maybe more important, and that is it shows the development of Judah's character. Judah is a slime ball in chapter 38, right? Not only because of the way he acts with this prostitute, which is despicable, but even really more than that. I know in our scale of thinking, we wouldn't say more, but in reality, the way that he treats his daughter-in-law, he has these wicked sons, they die, and then he refuses to give his daughter-in-law, the wife of the first and the second, to the third, thereby threatening to preserve the family line, which matters, again, given the promises of God. Now, and that's why he says too, and this is a very important point, and you would highlight this verse if you highlighted your Bible. The key to the story is when Judah says in verse 26, "She is more righteous than I." So, a Canaanite woman, his daughter-in-law, is more righteous than him in preserving the line through whom will come the Messiah. But before we even get there, you watch Judah develop in the Joseph story. I know you think it's all about, I don't see you, but Sunday school teachers everywhere think that this story is about Joseph. And in a way it is. And Joseph is commendable, and he is honored by he's given the blessing by Jacob of the firstborn. He is. So I don't want to take anything away from that. But Joseph is a flat character. He's a static character. There's no growth. There's no... he's righteous, and he pretty much stays righteous. Maybe there's a few little bugs in there. But by and large, but Judah goes from being... Chapter 37, what's Judah doing? See the traitors? We're selling our brother into slavery, which means he's dead, right? It's not. Don't think Judah is good. You're like, oh, he saved Joseph from dying. He would have died in that. No. When you sell him into slavery to go to Egypt, he's not going to live for more than a couple years. That's why they can say, when the brothers are down before Joseph in Egypt, one of our brothers is not. He's dead. They think they killed him, but without doing it themselves. So that's Judah, one willing to kill his own brother, not just his own brother, the favorite chosen brother. Compare that to the way that Judah treats the other favorite. I mean, once Joseph is gone, who's now the favorite son? Benjamin, because he's also the daughter. He's also the favorite wife, Rachel. Which, by the way, that's another flaw here, right? The favoritism of Jacob causes a lot of problems. That's not commendable. But Judah is going to be willing to give up his own life to save Benjamin. See how the flip effectively kills Joseph, now will kill himself to save Benjamin because he loves his dad. That is transformation of character, and not just transformation of character, but it's demonstration of not just a righteous character, but Judah demonstrates the kind of character that you want to see in a king. This is the kind of king the world needs, as Israel needs. They need a king who's willing to sacrifice himself for his brother. Not a king who lords it over, not a king who takes the wealth of the people away, but a king who will sacrifice everything. And so, this is really, Genesis 49 is a peek. I know it's easy to skip. It's easy to get lost in the details. You're like, oh, these blessings for the 12 sons, and like, I don't even know what's going on. And okay, go to the next chapter. That gets, you know, and then we get a couple guys die, and that's a little more interesting. You can't skip. And two, you think, like, for us, it's easy to kind of skip that because you're like, well, I'm not Zebulun, I'm not Naphtali, so it doesn't kind of, you know, your ears aren't perked up as much. But for those guys, for the ancient readers, the Israelites, they're listening real carefully, like, what's going to happen? And imagine the first time, Reuben, here comes a blessing. Jacob says, starts out like, you're my firstborn. And then he said, you're my might, you're the first sign of my strength. You violated my bed, away with you, is basically how it goes. So Reuben loses the blessing. Simeon is number two. He's probably going, it's my turn, you know, I'm going to get it. But Jacob takes Simeon and Levi together because they acted together. These apparently were close brothers, and they were guilty of using the sacred covenant symbol of circumcision as a means of deceit to slaughter the Canaanites. Now there's more to that story that we don't have time for, but point is here, brothers number two and three are knocked out of the running, and it says specifically, I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel, which, by the way, if you can then track the history of the tribes throughout the history of Israel, and you see these things happen. Now, Levi, how is Levi scattered? This is easy. The Levites are not given a tribal plot of land. They are made priests, which say, well, why? But they're priests and they're scattered throughout the land that way. By the way, that's a story of redemption, because of faithfulness of Levites. Later on in the book of Exodus, God is going to bless them. So they're going to be the priestly tribe, but still scattered. Simeon is going to get a little pocket of land inside Judah's land, and some of them are going to migrate to the north, and they're pretty much going to be dispersed. That's not what I'm going to focus on. Brother number four, verse 8 through 12. This is where your ears are really listening. This is the peak. This is the answer to the question. Really, that's what I need to frame it. This is the answer to the question. So what's the question? The question is, who's going to be the king? Right? That's the question that's been on the mind ever since God said to Abraham, you will be the father of kings. And then he says it to Jacob, you will be the father of kings. Well, I can't have a king from every son, and so the sons are wondering, the tribes want to know, and it's going to go on because there's not a king immediately. Jacob doesn't crown Judah. Obviously, they're living in Egypt. There's another king named Pharaoh. So, but he says here, your father's sons will bow down to you. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff. Interesting, Judah's staff had been somewhere else before, right? That was given in pledge for his wicked deed. Interesting, I mean, how God redeems that staff. That Judah's staff is now the ruler's staff, the king's scepter. It will not depart from his feet until it comes to whom it belongs. Which is pointing to someone in the future to whom it belongs, who is going to keep and maintain it. And if you think, well, who could this be that we've already been talking about? and you think back to the one, the seed of the woman, who will crush the serpent, then you're thinking along the right line. Because all this time, the faithful, not the wicked, they don't care, the faithful are wondering, how is God going to fulfill his promise? How is God going to redeem this creation? How is God going to destroy the serpent? How is God going to undo the fall? I just got an album this week. Andrew Peterson, really like Andrew Peterson. He's a young guy, about my age probably. And the album is The Longing for Eden, pretty much. The longing, expressed in different ways, but there's something in us, in the heart of the faithful at least, but even it's certainly remnants in all of those who are creating God's image, that knows we've lost something. God didn't make this world to be this way. And so that was just a good sort of reminder for me to hear some of those songs. But so that the faithful are wondering, who's going to bring us back? Who's going to restore us? And the answer is going to be, it's going to be through the tribe of Judah. So we have a narrowing here that's beginning. It's going to continue through the rest of the Old Testament. But it begins off with Adam, right? Adam is man, and he's the ruler. But then it's not Cain, because he's of the seed of the serpent, so he's outside of it. So it's narrowing down, and then it's of the line of Seth, and then Noah. But not that Noah has three sons, but it certainly can't be of Ham, because of the way he violated, dishonored his father. So that it's the promise is narrowing, and then okay, now it's one man, it's Abraham. But it's not all of Abraham's children; he had more than two. The others are completely ignored. Besides, Ishmael gets some blessing; the others are ignored. Isaac gets the blessing. It's going to be through Isaac. Okay, narrowing. But is it going to be through both of Isaac's sons? No. Esau is outside of the promise by choice too. I mean, I'm saying, is it God's sovereign decree? Yes. Is it Esau's decided decision? Is his choice his responsibility? Yes. Esau wants to live outside the promised land. He wants to live outside the blessing. So it's going to be Isaac. And it's going to be Jacob and not Esau. And then it's going to be all 12 of the sons, but there's going to be one who is going to rule. And then we're going to see that begin to be fulfilled with David. And that's the thing too. So you get to David, and when Samuel walks down to Bethlehem and he anoints David to be the king, and David's of the tribe of Judah, everyone's thinking, everyone who knew, and as the word got out that David's going to be the king, everyone's thinking, this is what we've been waiting for. Now, is David the one? Clearly not. I mean, he's faithful, and then he's not faithful. And so, maybe it's his son. It's not Solomon. I mean, Solomon starts out good, but then it gets really bad. Is it going to be Solomon's son? Is it going to be, right? That's what the faithful are watching. Who is going to be the one to whom it belongs? Who's going to redeem us? Who's going to rule us in righteousness? Who is, as Isaiah said, I hope you didn't forget anything we talked about Isaiah. Of course you did. That was But you do remember this because it's on your Christmas cards. They're waiting for the child who will be born, the son who will be given, upon whose shoulders a government will sit, who will rule with utter justice and righteousness, reigning on David's throne over his kingdom with justice and righteousness from that time on and forevermore. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of... That's what we have the start of here in Genesis, this narrowing. Right. Exactly. Simeon. One of my favorite people in the world. Simeon. And because He was. He knew these. He knew God's revelation, and he knew it was coming, and he was wait. Now he knew even more, because by the time the prophets got done, they knew that it wasn't just of the tribe of Judah, of the line of David. They knew he was going to be born in Bethlehem. They knew, you know, all those other prophecies about him as well. But it starts here. Okay, I have a couple minutes for questions. Judah is the fourth son of Leah. Joseph gets a blessing too. Joseph is the oldest of Rachel. And when you read Genesis 49, about half of the whole chapter is given to two sons. Judah gets 5 verses. Joseph gets about 5 verses. And the other sons pretty much get like 1 verse each. So Joseph, in the chapter before, in chapter 48, Jacob said to Joseph, bring in your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and he says, they're going to be like my own sons. That's why when you count the 12 tribes up, you never count Joseph, you count Ephraim and Manasseh. Joseph gets a double portion because his two sons were elevated. And then if you watch this too, and we're going to talk about some of this as we continue our journey through the scriptures, but we're not going to talk all about it, so I'll just kind of mention right now, like, whatever happens to these prophecies of Jacob to the 12 sons. Well, with Judah, I just mentioned, we get the king, David, and every king of Judah is from the line of David. There's a brief interruption with Athaliah, but they get rid of her and get back on track. Ephraim, who's the younger son of Joseph, but Jacob does this, so Ephraim is the favored one, is the other dominant tribe. There are two dominant tribes in the history of Israel. You can trace this out very easily. Ephraim and Judah. They live in the central hill country of Israel. The other tribes are kind of scattered on the periphery, except for Benjamin, who's wedged in the middle, which is exactly how the Bible says. It says, Benjamin, the lot for Benjamin fell between. That's Benjamin's destiny, is to be between the two big brothers, Judah and Ephraim. How is Ephraim dominant? Well, it's the place where the tabernacle is first located. Shiloh is in Ephraim. Joshua, the leader of the conquest, is of the tribe of Ephraim. The leader, the first king of the northern kingdom who splits away, Jeroboam, is of the tribe of Ephraim. So it's we don't see it because we kind of don't think in those terms so much, and we don't maybe study some of the details of the Old Testament. But the ancient reader, if you had said, which are the two dominant tribes in Israel, that was like, you know, an easy A. You know, that was an easy test question. But for us, we don't really think about that. But it all comes back to Genesis 49. Yes. I don't know exactly what is behind that. I mean, there could be totally innocent. It could reflect your greater knowledge of the subject than mine. Why does Jacob choose Judah and not Joseph? That is key. Joseph gets a great blessing, so I don't want to tell you anything from that. But I think it has to do with Judah's sacrificial kingly leadership. He is the leader of the brothers, right? Joseph never really is. Joseph is confronting them. Joseph's an outsider saying, you're spies. And then there's reconciliation, but Joseph is, it seems like too, you continue on in the passage, Joseph is always isolated in the administration of Pharaoh. He continues on that rule, and whereas Judah retains the role of leader. That's not the better answer, I think, is that Judah is Judah's character. It's not because he developed, it's because he ended up right, but we see that clear development. Yes.
When we assume that he is speaking from God,
Yes. 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 Yeah, I think that God through Jacob, when he says this about Dan or whatever, is saying the character that is in you is going to be the character of your tribe, of your descendants. You, and this is a good point to make from Genesis. Seed produces like seed. How does the phrase go in Genesis 1? Each according to his own kind. What do you see throughout the book of Genesis? Each according to his own kind. The skeptics want to say, oh, it's not true that Abraham lied about his wife, and then Isaac did the same thing. That's obviously just a duplication. Or maybe, like father, like son, each according to his own kind. And there's a lot of examples like that. But I'm out of time. And that is a wonderful commentary on the Old Testament. That's what God's doing again and again in the Old Testament. He's choosing the youngest boy, who they didn't even invite to the party, who's out tending the sheep, to shame the wise. So many examples of that. Let's pray. And Father, you do that, and you've done it with us. We are small, we are little, we bring nothing to you. We bring nothing to the table. Because of your grace, that we can be, as the seed of Abraham, be ones who bless the world, ones through whom you bless the world, because you've chosen to elevate the foolish, to magnify your grace, to magnify your glory, to confound the world and the wisdom of the world, which is indeed scratching its head at the things that you do that they don't understand. And so we praise you for working that way. We praise you for working in utter and supreme wisdom and in a way that is pure grace to us. And thank you for these examples. Thank you for the way that you were working through history, through the lives of the patriarchs, to bring at just the right time a son, a king, who would lay down his life for his brothers, for us, for our salvation. We thank you for him, and we pray in his name. Amen.